Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm Ellen Tauscher. I'm the former member of Congress from the old California 10th District in Walnut Creek, and I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. And I'm your moderator tonight. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm thrilled to be here to have my friend Steve Israel, my former colleague, former Democratic congressman from New York, MSNBC commentator, and the author of the new novel, Big Guns. It's really terrific. Steve represented New York as a member of Congress for 16 years. He left in 2016, as we say, unindicted and undefeated.
It's a triumph these days.
Yeah. We have that in common, plus many other things. He also served as the House Democrats' chief political strategist from 2011 to 2015. President Bill Clinton once called Steve one of the most thoughtful members of Congress, to which Steve later said, "That really doesn't mean much at all." Steve is currently the distinguished writer in residence at Long Island University in New York and has published two critically acclaimed satires of Washington, D.C. His latest Big Guns skewers the gun lobby. Humorist Christopher Buckley called it hilarious, and Steve's mother says it's the best thing he's done since eighth grade. On a more serious note, Steve's New York Times op-ed, "Nothing Will Change After the Las Vegas Shooting," went viral, and his Mick.com video on gun violence received nearly 3.5 million viewers. Steve is currently chairperson of the Global Institute at Long Island University and a strategic advisor to both the Democratic Governors Association and the think tank Third Way. Today we're going to have a wide-ranging conversation about all things, including perhaps politics and possibilities for change. Please welcome my very good friend, Steve Israel.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I forgot to do my gavels.
Whoa.
So now we're official.
If you had stayed in Congress a little longer, you might have had a bigger gavel as Speaker of the House.
Well, we have a very good speaker that actually represents San Francisco.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to getting her back in the speaker's chair, perhaps in November. So, Steve, I love this book.
Thank you. I loved
it for so many reasons. You're smart as heck. I'm going to tell your mother. But even beyond that, I love satires. I mean, they are a very different genre. I grew up reading British murder mysteries, and my mother encouraged us to read them because she said one time, you know, they don't have guns in the UK. They have to be very clever about how they kill people. And that's proven to be true. But let's just start with some of the names in this book, because you not only skewer virtually everyone, I would say you run through them. But some of the names are quite amazing. There's a Supreme Court justice named Justice Scalion.
What are you saying?
Who could that be? You've got the majority leader is Tom Doolittle.
Are you detecting a trend?
You've got kind of a swarmy businessman whose name is Sid, married to a woman named Stormy. And then he has all of these really funny and very clever groups and associations that are lined up, for guns. One is called ASPPA, Armed Airline Pilots and Passengers Association. The bill that is talked about here, that is such a clever vehicle, and actually gets signed into law by the president for all the wrong reasons, you'll be shocked to find out, is called the AFFFA, the American Freedom from Fear Act. And this is so to make sure that everybody has a gun. And then you've got the OMMAG, 1 Million Mad Mothers Against Guns. followed by two other groups that are religious in nature: priests who pack and the Shabbat shootout. So, you know, the definition of satire, I mean, I tend to look these things up because I want to be sure I'm not going crazy. The use of humor, irony, exaggeration, or ridicule to expose and criticize people's stupidity or vices, particularly in the context of contemporary politics or other topical issues. So, Steve, you know, I'm a big fan. Talk about what, you know, your previous book was a big success. Talk about what made you do this, and why did you choose satire to unveil the perfidy of this entire situation?
Sure. Well, thank you. It's such a pleasure and honor to be here with Ellen. When I was elected to Congress in 2000, and I got there in 2001, one of the immediate lessons that I learned was you never say no to Ellen Tauscher when she asked you to do something. And she kindly invited me here, and I just couldn't say no to her. You know, I grew up on Long Island with three dreams. One, I wanted to be a novelist when I was a child. Two, and I don't know if you had this dream, I wanted to one day be in the United States Congress. I had that, started dreaming that dream in fourth grade. And third, I wanted to play center field for the New York Mets. And since I was horrible at baseball, I had to give up that third dream. Although, these days, the Mets are playing so poorly, I think I could play center field for the Mets, who will be in town tomorrow playing the Giants. And I never thought that I would actually write a book, although that was my dream. I got elected to Congress in 2000. And I'm sure you had these experiences as well. I had a front row seat to the most extraordinary moments in American history and saw these characters. I remember right after 9/11, I know you were in the rooms too. I was invited to the Cabinet Room and the Roosevelt Room with the President and the Vice President and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. Now understand, until that moment, the most important meeting I had ever had in my political career was when I was a town councilman for the town of Huntington, and I met with the highway superintendent to talk about paving. And now I'm in the Cabinet Room, and as Ellen knows, you know, you're not allowed to take any kind of personal device into these meetings. These are classified meetings, and so you have to put them in a little cubbyhole and then go into the rooms. And I would see these stories unfold. Uh-huh. And I would hear, particularly with Vice President Cheney, the most absurd dialogue that you could imagine. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And I would run out, and I didn't write anything that was classified, anything that I couldn't, but I would just start writing about what I had seen uh-huh. and the characters. And that resulted in my first book, which was a novel called The Global War on Morris, about this guy, he doesn't like politics, he doesn't watch C-SPAN, he just wants to be left alone, and somehow Dick Cheney believes that he's a major terrorist trying to overthrow the government of the United States of America, this like schlemiel from Great Neck, New York. And it was all based on the stuff that I was hearing and seeing. If I had done a serious book about the excesses of the federal government and the surveillance, it would have sold in my mother's house, maybe. But I learned from my predecessors in satire that satire is an exceptional way of bringing people into a story.
That's
and
right.
Trying to make a point without hitting them over the head with a 2x4.
Exactly.
And that's why I decided to apply that to the ludicrous debate over gun safety in Congress.
No, I think what you've done is you've taken what is a ludicrous debate. You know, we've had our share of tragedies out here. I actually went to Congress in 1996. I beat Bill Baker, who was mm-hmm. a Republican incumbent who was in the majority. We had the 101 California Street murders in 1994, and he wouldn't meet with the people from the district whose spouses had been killed. And I ran against him in 1996 and beat him. And in no small part because women mm-hmm. were outraged, particularly that was a big year for women's vote. But it was really people just couldn't believe that even if you don't agree with somebody, if your spouse has been murdered, and it was somebody that had a gun that he really shouldn't have had, why don't you sit down and explain why you voted against the assault weapons ban? That should be something that you should have to do. And you know, it's part of the debate, but I think this idea of using satire to take what is, in many people's mind, a ludicrous debate, the fact that we have more guns in this country than people, and that you know, people that really shouldn't have them, whether they're criminals or people with mental illnesses, they seem to be able to get their hands on it. And it's a huge industry. And there's indemnification for the manufacturers that nobody else has. Can you imagine if I said, you know, no, if that toaster that you just bought from Amazon blows up in your house and burns your house down, they are indemnified. But do you believe that gun manufacturers are all indemnified? They can't be sued by anybody. And, you know, they make products that are easily changed and easily moved around and adopted to have big clips, and it's completely crazy. But when you decided to use satire to explain this, the book is fascinating because it tells a story that's plausible.
Right.
So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So while I was in Congress, 16 years, 52 mass shootings in America in the 16 years that I was in Congress. And after every major mass shooting, the number one question that I would get in my district, and I assume the question, same question, was always, when will Congress do something? When will you stop this? And by the way, that question wasn't asked just by Democrats. I had a very competitive district. I had a 50-50 district.
So did I.
Which meant at any one time, as many people who loved me also hated me. And it didn't matter. Republicans, Democrats, NRA members would stop me in the streets and say, why doesn't Congress do something? Don't do everything, just do something. Strengthen background checks. Stop people, you know, no fly, no buy. If the federal government thinks you're too dangerous to get on a plane, you shouldn't be able to get a military-style assault weapon. Do something. And I knew what the answer was in my heart. And the answer was, when will Congress do something? Probably never. And I wanted to explain why. And the best way I know how to explain tough issues in politics, for me, is through satire. Mm-hmm. It's by being sharp and snarky and writing from the inside. And so here's that kernel of truth. Every satire must have a kernel of truth. If it doesn't have a kernel of plausibility, it's nothing but Three Stooges throwing pies at one another. And one day, I was reading my New York Times. I was in my district. This is after the shooting in Sandy Hook. And I was watching President Obama on television. Do you all remember this? He had tears streaming down his cheeks. And I said to myself, now we're going to act. Now we're going to act. And flew to Washington. And we did act. We lowered a flag. We had moments of silence. We tweeted our hearts and our prayers. And that was it. Nothing. However, state and local governments, they were acting.
Right.
Remember this? They were doing stuff. Sensible stuff. Well, one day, one morning, about 2 weeks after Newtown, I was reading my New York Times in my dining room on Long Island, and I read, I'll never forget this, because it triggered my story. On page A9 of the New York Times, there was this article. Article about the small city of Nelson, Georgia, whose leaders were so repulsed by the fact that other cities and state governments were passing gun control that they went in a different direction. They passed a city ordinance mandating, requiring that every resident of Nelson, Georgia must own and carry a gun.
Oh, great.
And I thought that the editors of The Onion had infiltrated the New York Times. I was like, this can't be. This is fake news before there was fake news, only it wasn't fake news. This happened. And Ellen, that's where I had my story. What if this happened at the federal level? What if Congress decides that they're going to pass a bill that requires all of you, everybody in this room, to own and carry a firearm, and even if you don't want one. If you don't have one, you get fined. Unless you're under the age of 7 in my book. I made sensible exceptions for children under the age of 7, which was debated down from 14. Because you've been to those leadership meetings. You know what that's all about.
Yeah.
And so I took this Georgia kernel of truth and did what satire does. I embellished on it. And I expanded it. And I'll close on this by telling you one story about how sometimes satire blurs with reality. So did you serve with Billy Long from Missouri?
Yes, briefly.
So Billy Long is really one of my favorite Republicans in Congress. Big, gregarious, boisterous Missouri guy, massive jowls. Before he was in Congress, he was an auctioneer. So you can imagine. And one day I was sitting on the members' balcony, and we should talk about the members' balcony.
Yes.
It's the most beautiful and bipartisan place in all of Capitol Hill. It's where people talk to one another as human beings. And our former colleagues had been accustomed to the fact that when I was working on my iPhone, I was probably writing a book.
Right.
Because I wrote it all on my device. And very frequently they would say, Israel, are you writing about me? And if I said no, they were disappointed.
Yeah.
Because in Washington, we read, you know, we read the index, check our names. If our names are there, we read the whole book. If not, it's not worth reading. And Billy Long comes out. He says, Israel, you writing about me? I said, Billy, I'm not. He said, you writing your next novel? I said, I am, Billy. He said, what's it about? And I said, well, Billy, let me ask you a question. What would you think if Congress entertained a bill that would mandate that every American must own a gun? And he looked at me, he said, we haven't? And I said, oh, my God, what have I done?
Yeah.
I thought he was going to go to Ledge Council and have the bill. And then he said this, and this is in the book.
And he wanted to be original co-sponsor.
Yeah, original co-sponsor. It's in the book. I mean, a lot of these quotes that are in this book
are real.
Are real. They're real. And he looks at me and he says, well, you know, you Democrats passed Obamacare, and that forced everybody to have health insurance. Why not pass a bill that forces everybody to have life insurance? And, you know, my jaw dropped, and then I regained composure and wrote it down. I think it's on page 58. I'm not sure. It's in there. Yeah.
Well, so we already have some great questions.
Okay.
And they're political in nature, but they certainly talk about the book, your views on the ages of Democratic Party leaders.
Mm-hmm.
They're old.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been pretty outspoken on this. I did a piece in USA Today 2 weeks ago, so I won't hold back. I was Nancy Pelosi's chief political lieutenant for 4 years. I chaired the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee.
You did a great job.
Thank you. My job was defeating Republicans and electing Democrats. I know this is a nonpartisan event, but that's what the chairman of the DCCC does, and the chairman of the NRCC has a different job, beat Democrats, elect Republicans. We're like two football coaches on opposite ends of the field. And that required me to spend a lot of time with Nancy Pelosi. There's this false narrative that she wants to stay at all costs. I sat with her the day before and after the elections in 2012, 14, and 16. And her mindset was not, I've got to keep the gavel. I've got to keep the title minority leader. Her mindset was, one, I have 9 grandchildren.
Right.
And I really want to spend more time with them. Two, I do believe there needs to be a generational change. But the person who replaces me has to have capacity.
Right.
And what do I mean by that? Number one, when I chaired the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, I hate that there's money in politics. It's why I left. But under the rules we have now, there's money in politics. When I chaired DCCC, of the roughly $200 million that we raised to elect candidates, Nancy Pelosi was responsible for half of that.
Yeah.
Half of that.
She's a prodigious fundraiser.
Yeah.
Indefatigable. How much time? She works 90 hours a week.
It's extraordinary. Two, somebody who can govern a very contentious caucus.
Right.
I mean, Ellen and I were both blue dogs. There are blue dogs and new Dems. There's a Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and the Congressional Asian and Pacific Islanders Caucus. There's a ton of caucuses. It's a caucus of cauci. and you need somebody who can keep it all together. Number three.
The Cowboy Boot Caucus?
The
Cowboy Boot Caucus.
Absolutely. I was the chairman of the Caucus on Caucuses. It was, right? The meetings were lonely but entertaining. And so somebody who can keep it all together. Number three, somebody who can negotiate. People don't understand when you are the Speaker of the House or the Democratic leader, you're negotiating with a White House.
Right.
You're negotiating with the Senate Democratic leader and the Senate Republican leader. You're negotiating with the Republican leader of the House. And she did an exceptional job. So that was a long-winded way of telling you that I think that at some point she may make the choice to go, but she wants to make sure that when she leaves, she doesn't leave in a vacuum. And finally, and I'm particularly sensitive to this, this argument that this generation of old people need to step aside, why just the woman?
Right.
Why just Nancy Pelosi?
Right.
I mean, maybe, you know, if every, let them all go. Let them all go. if that's what it's about.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you.
Okay.
So please give us your midterm election predictions.
Oh, well, caution. I was on a stage like this in the New York Times on election night of 2016 with Congressman Hakeem Jeffries.
Right, from New York.
From New York, where we had the same question at 7 o'clock that night. The polls closed at 9 o'clock, New York time. And I said, well, of course Hillary Clinton's going to win. So don't listen to me. I don't have a very good record of predicting accurately. However, I get to travel. Now that I'm out of Congress, I get to travel the country answering that question. And I travel with a Republican former member of Congress named Tom Davis, who chaired the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. And we do these events where we talk about what we think will happen. So here is what I think will happen. Barring any unforeseen circumstances, which with this president are the only predictable elements. The only thing that we can predict is something unpredictable.
So it's not an October surprise, it's an everyday surprise?
I actually think it's going to be a November surprise, and we can talk about that. Yeah. On a bad night for the Democrats, I think that they are 3 to 5 votes short of the majority. On an expected night for the Democrats, I think that there are probably 3 to 5 votes over the majority. On a really exceptional night, maybe they get it into the low double digits. Mm-hmm. Now, here's why it's going to be this narrow. It's because of gerrymandering. It's right. Because of redistricting. Ellen's party and my party made a catastrophic mistake in 2009. We were so swept up in our success as Democratic president, Democratic majority in the House, 259 seats, 29 Democratic governors. Most of the state legislatures were Democrats, majority in the Senate. And you know what the Republicans did? God bless you, who are Republicans, God bless them. They couldn't care less. They went local. They spent $100 million defeating Democratic governors, defeating Democratic state legislators, took control of redistricting, and drew themselves maps for the exact environment they are in now. So they've got sandbags. When this tsunami happens, if it happens, they've sandbagged those districts, which is why I think we're looking at a very narrow majority. And we may not know on election night.
No, we may not. We may not know. But gerrymandering is a big piece of this. Most people do not know that governors control redistricting every 10 years. So in the 0 year of a decade, the Census Bureau comes in and they check everybody and they count and they say, where are you and where are you now? And they say, okay, look, these people have moved. And in the last 30 years, migration has been mostly from the north and northeast to the south and southwest. So California got some seats in 2000, Arizona got a couple of seats, Texas got a couple of seats, Florida's gotten a couple of seats, and they subtract them because there is a fixed number of 435 members of the House. And so what this does is it reassigns to where populations have gone out of states and into states. But Republican governors, not just in 2009, there have been more Republican governors since 1960. And they have run this game quietly and controlled redistricting to the point where it is almost impossible in some cases to get their numbers down in the old-fashioned way because they packed seats in a way that Republicans are going to win. You just saw that North Carolina...
Yeah.
Again, so North Carolina, the Supreme Court of the state of North Carolina threw out their redistricting map from 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and said, you have to do a new one. They took 18 months to do it, because they're not confused, and they gave them a new one, and then a year later, North Carolina Supreme Court goes, this still isn't good. So they're still, you know, manipulating these circumstances, but I think our party has been asleep at the switch.
Yep. Yeah.
Because in the end, there's a reason why you have to have more than 25 governors. You want to have enough to be able to run the table so that you can actually get things done. And things like redistricting, which are done both on the local level for the state assembly and the state senate and for Congress, where you actually have one man, one vote, and where you have districts that are competitive and where people, you know, can't die in office and 5 years later still get reelected.
Yeah. By the way, if you guys want to see the most egregious example of redistricting, Google Pennsylvania 7.
Oh, boy.
Pennsylvania 7, the 7th Congressional District of Pennsylvania. The district was called Goofy Kicking Donald Duck. Serious. And that's because the borders of the district looked like a cartoonist drew the Disney character Goofy kicking the Disney character Donald Duck. And they had to do that in order to carve out Democrats and bring in Republicans.
Right.
Now, that district, because Pennsylvania has a Democratic governor, mm-hmm. that district is now more fair. It's no longer Goofy kicking Donald Duck. It's more just like Goofy hanging out by himself. Mm-hmm. But as a result, the Republican member there, a guy named Congressman Meehan, he realized, now that I have a fair district, right. I can't survive. And so he retired from Congress.
Well, he also had another problem.
And he had another problem as well. And that district is likely to go to the Democrats. But the good news is, for those of you who, whether you support President Trump or not, I think it's clear that this is a president who needs checks and balances. And the good news is that there will be checks and balances after November. It's just going to be a very slim majority.
Right. So what do you think about the 3D printed guns and their plans, their blueprints being posted online?
This is the craziest thing. I had a piece, an op-ed in the New York Times about these 3D guns. So we now have the technologies. You can go out and buy a printer.
Livermore Lab,
3D, right. Well, now you can go into the local office supply store and buy a printer. You don't want to get a cheap printer. If you want to make a 3D gun, you want to get more expensive one. So maybe spend $1,500, $1,200. You can take it home to bring it home, plug it in, and you can make a fireable, lethal gun.
Out of plastic.
Printer. Out of the same plastic that makes Legos. Same plastic that makes
Legos. Which is not detected in magnetometers.
Right. So you can go to the airport. It goes right through. And there's no way of detecting.
You have to take your shoes off first, though.
Take your shoes off. make sure no more than 3.2 ounces.
Yeah, no shampoo.
But you can get a 3D gun. So there was
Satire. We just did satire.
Yeah, there you go. This is an example of how crazy it's become, and it's reflected in the book. The first president to realize that we shouldn't have undetectable weapons was Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
It was Ronald Reagan who signed the Undetectable Firearms Act. And it was renewed by President George Bush. And then renewed by President Bill Clinton. And then renewed by President George W. Bush. It expired in 2013. And I was the lead Democrat on the bill to extend it. And I thought this was going to be a no-brainer.
Oh, yeah.
No-brainer. Oh, my God, it was as if I was abolishing the Second Amendment. I mean, I was getting death threats because I didn't think it was a good idea to allow people to go through a metal detector with a gun, get on a plane, and shoot somebody. We ended up passing it. That was the good news. Congressman Howard Coble from North Carolina.
Was
a Republican. We ended up passing it, but it was so watered down by the NRA that the good news is we passed it. The bad news is we didn't pass what we should have. The good news is the debate and that atmosphere is also in big guns, and will also help explain to you why nothing happens on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
The atmosphere?
From the book.
So I'll tell you this story. I hope it will tell you everything that you need to know about to answer that question, why doesn't Congress act when it comes to gun safety? I was a member of the House Appropriations Committee, which was considered one of the more powerful committees in Congress. Why? Pop quiz. Why was the Appropriations Committee? Money. You're going, yeah, we were appropriated. We effectively wrote the checks. And every year there's a ritual in the Appropriations Committee, where Democrats would try and attach riders to funding bills on gun safety. So the bill funding the Department of Homeland Security, we tried to attach a rider called No Fly, No Buy. I explained that. I'm going to get on a plane at San Francisco International tomorrow to fly back to New York. I can get on that plane because I'm not deemed a threat. But somebody who is deemed a threat can't go on that plane, but could then go on the internet and order an AR-15. How does that make sense? So we said, no fly, no buy. Defeated in a party line vote. 89% of Americans support no fly, no buy. Then we tried to attach to the Department of justice, stronger background checks. 93% of Americans support stronger background checks. 75%, I believe, of NRA members support stronger background checks. No brainer, right, guys? Right? Defeated in a party line vote. And we kept putting votes up like that. Then we went into the members only elevator, right? And Ellen knows there are a few places on Capitol Hill that are really honest, where you can really talk to one another. The members only elevator during votes is one of them, because members only means members only. No press, no staff, just members. And one of my Republican colleagues was unhappy with me and said, why did you force those gotcha votes on us? Oh. A gotcha vote is, you know, a vote staged, you know, to make you pay a political price. And he said that was a gotcha vote. And I said, well, why do you think that was a gotcha vote? He said, well, because you put me in between, you know, my gun voters and the other people in the district. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. The majority of folks in your district, I know this because I'm the chairman of the DCCC and we have polled this in your district. The majority of your constituents support these things. Why would you vote against them? Why are you against them? And this member looked at me and said, oh, no, I'm for them. I support these things. I said, but you just voted no. He said, no, personally,
yeah,
I support this. But I can't go back to my district because if I do, I will catch a primary.
I will be threatened.
I'll get a primary. This is the result of this gerrymandering.
Right.
Republican districts have gone so far to the right, and by the way, some Democratic districts have gone so far to the left, that the average member of Congress doesn't wake up in the morning afraid of a challenge from the other party, but a challenge from their own party. And there is no issue. It's called voter intensity.
Right.
There is no issue more intense for Republican primary voters than guns.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It drives
which is what this
right
book is about.
Box.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yep. No. And voter intensity in the 18 election is very important because talk a little bit about the realities of presidential election voter turnout and midterms and what a paltry state we're in because so few people vote in midterms and that's why predicting the size of the wave is difficult. We know that there's a wave coming, but in the end, it's all about who gets out and votes.
Voter turnout explains every gray hair on this head. I didn't have a gray hair on the head when I was DTRIP chair. Let me give you a very specific example. I was supposed to be on MSNBC today talking about this, but the memorial service for John McCain, which I thought was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, bounced me. But I was looking, I'll give you an example of the importance of voter turnout. The Democratic primary for governor in Florida yesterday. In 2000, Democrats lost Florida. Donald Trump won Florida. He won it by 113,000 votes. 113,000 votes. That's nothing,
right?
Republican performance in Florida in the presidential election was about 82%.
Right.
Democratic performance in the Florida election in the presidential was 74%. Had Hillary Clinton's campaign gotten that turnout up to parity with Republicans, she would have won Florida and probably would have won the Electoral College. So voter turnout is everything, particularly in a midterm election.
That's right. So this is a great question. Is reality stranger than satire now?
Man. Well, here's the thing. Satire is on life support right now because of the reality. I think the most brilliant satirist in America in recent history is this guy, Christopher Buckley, who wrote Thank You for Smoking, Little Green Men, No Way to Treat a First Lady, Supreme Courtship. He's my my idol, and I got to meet him after writing my first book, and I've gotten to know him. He's taking a hiatus from satire.
Right.
He's out of it, and when I asked him why, he said, Because the American people are getting satire every morning when they wake up to a tweet.
Well, there's a question here. Is there a danger that Donald Trump will make satire passé?
And he has. That's a great question. He has. So the market for satire right now is just, well, the market for fiction is flat. The market for nonfiction is robust. Everybody wants to know what the heck is going on and what are we going to do about it? So nonfiction is just flying off the shelves. Fiction, unless your name is James Patterson, mm-hmm. Whoever it is, unless you're writing a book that's selling in an airport, fiction is pretty flat. Satire is really in trouble right now. And that disturbs me because I don't want to sound presumptuous, so take me out of the equation. The greatest literary patriots in American history were satirists. What would we have done without Mark Twain, mm-hmm. without Joseph Heller? They were able, as we said at the outset of this, they were able to bring people into an intellectual argument with humor, right. With a sharpness that people might otherwise reject. And so I hope that satire comes back. What is replacing satire is this. It's the Trump tweets, but it's being replaced by parody.
Right.
So people are getting, they turn on Kimmel, or they mm-hmm. turn on Colbert,
right.
and they get their information with a rim shot. Satire is not a rim shot. It's nuanced. Mm-hmm. It takes you through. You have to weave somebody through a story.
And it has the kernel of truth, which makes it different than cynicism.
Yes. That's
exactly
right.
Because they're related.
Yes, yes. So satire is under tremendous pressure right now, which is why you all have to buy my book at the end of this. So I can justify it to my publisher.
So getting back to the book, why is the NRA so powerful in the United States?
It's a great question. I know Ellen has views on this as well. I think the conventional assumption that the NRA spends all this money defeating opponents and electing friends is wrong, flat wrong. The NRA spent about $13 million in the past five cycles. It's about average for a pretty significant special interest. The issue is what I said before, it's voter intensity. So when you see, I'm not sure about here in your city, but on Long Island, I mean, you see I see bumper stickers all over, I'm NRA and I vote, all over. That tells you everything you need to know.
One issue voters,
voter intensity. Now here's a difference between progressives and gun voters. Progressives, God bless us, my congresswoman voted against background checks. But she's okay on climate. She's okay on reproductive freedoms. She's against cuts to education, so I'll overlook that. But the folks who drive around with a I'm on NRA and I vote, you know what they think? My congressman can vote against me on everything.
Right.
As long as he votes with me on guns, I'm with them.
And I vote.
I come out. You don't have to remind me. The NRA is powerful because they mobilize those one-issue voters. And on the other side of the equation, progressives are just more tolerant of members of Congress who vote against us on guns but are with us on other things. When our intensity equals gun voting intensity,
right.
you will see a change.
That's right. So you talked about when you were in fourth grade wanting to be a member of Congress.
Yeah.
If you were a child growing up now, would you still dream of being in Congress? And do you encourage young people to think about going to Congress?
Well, I probably would have tried to make $1 billion first and then run for Congress. Yeah, I wouldn't change a thing. I had, and I know, Ellen, lived this, 16 of the most glorious years of my life, Mm-hmm. There was no privilege greater than serving in the United States Congress. And I think it's more important than ever for us to engage young people. Here's what I worry about the most now. I'm working on the issue of civic engagement mm-hmm. and community service. I think it helps explain why President Trump gets away with what he gets away with, because there is a fundamental and shocking ignorance that people have about how government operates.
Civics.
Here's a statistic for you. Fewer than 45% of Americans can name all three branches of government, but 78% of Americans can name all three stooges. 12% of Americans believe that the Bill of Rights includes the right to own a pet. The right to own a pet. When you lose that civic understanding, you become untethered.
Right.
You lose your bearings. You become disconnected from the fundamental virtues and values of the country in which you live. And that is happening more and more every day. It explains why Donald Trump can say the most ridiculous things and people believe it. Now, I think we've lost, I don't want to be too mawkish here, I think we've lost a good part of the current generation, but if we get started on fourth graders right now, we'll be okay.
Yeah. So do you think Donald Trump's endorsement will help or hurt in November? It cuts both ways.
Yeah, cuts absolutely. You're right. It cuts, and you know, in the 23 districts that are represented by Republicans, which Hillary Clinton won, please endorse the Republican, Mr. President.
Yeah.
And districts that where you have a big Trump base, of course, it's going to help. The thing is this, that and here I don't want to agitate anybody, but look, folks. The Democrats have won all the blue seats they can win.
Right.
There are no more blue seats to win. They've got to win in this midterm election districts in Kansas,
purple
Iowa, purple seats, Florida. They've got to win districts in Orange County, California. And those are purple districts. And the path to the majority is in those districts.
We have seven of those seats, you know, in California.
Yes.
Where Hillary won and Dana Rohrabacher won and Jeff Dunham won, Hillary won, and you have to think, what were those people thinking?
Yeah.
So what do you think about who will run in 2020, and what issues do you think will be the most important?
Ellen Tauscher.
No. No.
No?
No, you can't afford me. I didn't.
That's why I say she's the gold standard. Look, I have my own personal feelings. I'm going to give you a really cold-blooded diagnostic. Again, I may agitate some of you, but let me just, this is the DCCC chairman in me, which is just win. You're just, who cares who it is? Just win, right? We've got to win in 2020. I cannot abide Donald Trump in a second term finish completing his sweep of the Supreme Court, right? And so here's my analysis. I won't get too into the weeds, but think this through. I think one of the reasons that we lost, two of the reasons we lost in 2016 are two counties in Pennsylvania, Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, and Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania. Luzerne, now maybe I know more about this because I chair DTRIP, so I know these rough counties. Luzerne County voted for Barack Obama.
Right.
And voted massively for Donald Trump. Lackawanna County in western Pennsylvania was a blowout for Obama and Biden, and Donald Trump almost won it. The night before the election, where was Donald Trump? He was in Luzerne County.
Right.
He was in Luzerne. He was pretty smart. Now, why is that such a big deal? Well, when we lost Luzerne by the number we did, and we were barely competitive in Lackawanna, we lost Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It was 20,000 votes.
Right.
Maybe a few more than that. But there was 20 electoral votes.
Right.
We lost those 20 electoral votes. There was hardly any place else Hillary could go.
That's right.
To make them up.
Right.
So I want to know who can win Luzerne County and Lackawanna County.
Right.
There happens to be a former vice president who was born in Lackawanna County.
Right. Scranton.
Who's beloved there. And I know this because when I chaired DCCC and he said, Send me where I can be helpful to candidates. I said, go to Lackawanna, go to Luzerne, go to Western Pennsylvania, go to Ohio, go to Michigan, go to Wisconsin, go to Florida. That's where Joe Biden does best. And I know there are lots of differing opinions, and I'm respectful to all those opinions. I just want to win, and I want a candidate, whether it's Biden or somebody else, I want somebody who can win those two counties, because you win those two counties, we are almost there. Then you just have to win one other state. Could be Florida, could be Ohio, and then Donald Trump has nowhere to go to get to the electoral votes he needs.
That's right. So where will change come from if not in Congress? Where do you get your hope from? Youth engagement?
Yeah.
Changing options? What do you think?
So I am so impressed by these Parkland kids.
Yeah.
I think that's where change comes from students like that. By the way, one of the reasons that the Parkland kids are so
authentic.
So authentic, but also so effective is, you know why? The state of Florida has a civics requirement in high school.
Right.
So they studied this stuff.
That's
they
right.
studied government
That's
in
right.
high school.
That's
Every
right.
state should have that requirement. Every state should have that requirement. I think they might change the game. In this midterm election, there's an overlap of maybe 5 to 10 districts that are very competitive, but also represent the difference between an incumbent who votes 100% with the NRA and a challenger who won't. These kids, if they just, and you know, Ellen knows this, we don't have to win all 10 of those districts or 15. Win 3. There is nothing more elucidating to our former colleagues
right.
than watching a colleague lose an election to ideology.
Right.
They'll turn on a dime, the right. ones who are left. So these kids can change this. And if they change it, they become role models to other young people. And that's how a movement begins.
Right.
So that's why I'm so optimistic. I said, I think we may have lost this generation, not the kids. You know, the people who are going to rallies with Donald Trump holding their babies. We've lost them. But if these kids continue this, I couldn't be more hopeful and optimistic about where our country's going to go.
I agree. Isn't the dysfunction in Congress almost entirely due to the influence of money? Until that is addressed, can anything really change?
It's one of the two problems, I think. Money and gerrymandering.
Right.
My next book is likely to be on this topic because my agent, you know, I just told you that nonfiction is hot, fiction is not, so my agent came up with a brilliant idea that my third book should be nonfiction. he said, you know, actually, it would be nice to actually sell some of these things other than to your mom. And so my next book is likely to be, it's sitting with Simon and Schuster right now, called Common Ground, One Insider's Search for Compromise on Capitol Hill.
Wow.
Where I'm going to take people behind the scenes. People think that bipartisanship is dead on Capitol Hill. That Capitol Hill is a cemetery, you know, for civility. It's not true. There are signs of life.
Right.
Notwithstanding gerrymandering and money, it's that balcony I told you about where
That's
Billy
right.
Long and I talked. It's that members-only dining room. You know what else? Everybody hates these junkets, these Codells. I'll tell you what. Now I'm out of Congress. I can say they were so wonderful in bringing members of Congress
right.
together. When you're sitting next to somebody that you thought you hated for 16 hours on an airplane,
right.
you know, you start to realize, not so bad.
Yeah.
Not so bad. You're not breathing fire. And so those bonding experiences are very important. Having said that, money is insidious.
Yeah.
I quantified, I did this piece, Confessions of a Congressman. I quantified it 16 years in Congress. Separate apart from the DCCC, I raised $20 million for my own reelections mm-hmm. in increments of $5,000 because you can't take corporate money and it can't exceed $5,000. I spent 5,200 hours in those little cubicles at DCCC dialing and double dialing and would go like this. You know, hi, Harry, it's Congressman Israel. How's your wife, Sheila? Oh, Shelley? Oh, I'm sorry. How's Shelley? Harry, listen, I got a tough re-election. Can I count on you for 5,000? How about 3,000? 2,500? 2,000? Okay, thanks, Harry. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, bye.
Next phone.
Next.
Hi, Jim. How are you, Jim? I spent 5,200 hours doing that, and I personally consumed 1,200 soggy egg rolls at the Tortilla Coast at PAC fundraisers. It's
yeah.
just, it's an
it's
opportunity
crazy.
Cost. So it explains a lot about the condition of Congress.
Well, speaking of Codells,
yes.
you know, and John McCain's Arizona funeral was today, and then he'll lie in state tomorrow and then be buried at the at Annapolis at the Naval Academy on Saturday after a great service at the National Cathedral mm-hmm. School, which is where my daughter went to school. I have a Codell story about John McCain. He was absolutely the funniest person I've ever met in my life. And so irreverent and so just fascinating. But I was on a trip with him. We were going to the Munich Security Conference. And he took Hillary Clinton, myself, Lindsey Graham, and I, and John went to the Ukraine first because you couldn't get there and work 3 days after flying overnight to Europe. You couldn't get there without being exhausted. He wanted to be exhausted, and he always liked doing 7 or 8 things at once. We're going to meet with the president of the Ukraine who had been poisoned by the Russians. people thought it was while having borscht. So we take off. John's sitting next to me, and I said to him, no question about it, John, this is going to be a great trip, but do we have to have lunch with the guy? They poisoned him at lunch. And he goes, what? He goes, you're kidding. He goes, Graham. And Lindsay's kind of fallen asleep. He goes, you're our food tester. So,
oh, I love it.
This very, very handsome man who had been who was the president of the Ukraine had been poisoned. He was now a shade of green. His face was all pockmarked. It was just a horrible transformation. They nearly killed him. He's sitting across the table from us, and it's Hillary, me, John, and Lindsay. And in they come, these guys with these white gloves, and they put something down in front of us. It's borscht. Oh. So I kind of look at it, and I kind of turn my head and look at John, and John goes, Mr. President, this is how we do it in the United States. This is why all of us are walking around right now. Lindsay? The president of the Ukraine burst out laughing. Lindsay, of course, picks up the spoon, kind of takes a sip, puts the spoon down and goes, you know, so much for, you know, serious diplomacy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, tell me a John McCain story.
The very first press conference that I ever did was with John McCain on the steps of the Theodore Roosevelt birthplace on East 20th or 21st Street in Manhattan. I had just been elected. This was February or so. And he invited me to a press conference on the McCain-Feingold Campaign Finance Reform Act. And I went, this is not as good as your story. Nobody was poisoned and no gagging. But, you know, I was so intimidated to be on the steps with John McCain. I was as nervous as can be, just completely rattled. And I stood on those steps and John McCain said his stuff. And then he turned to me and I did my thing and finished, and I said, Senator, I have to tell you, you know, I got to admit, I'm a little bit intimidated. And he looked at me and comforted me by saying, you really should be. You weren't that good.
Yeah. Well, God bless him.
God bless him. God bless him.
So I think this is a good question because I think people misunderstand sometimes being a moderate, which both Steve and I were on the spectrum of Democrats, and bipartisanship.
Yeah.
And we actually know moderates that aren't very bipartisan, mm-hmm. and we actually know conservatives that are bipartisan. John McCain was a perfect example of a bipartisan conservative. So can you be bipartisan without compromising your core principles?
Yeah. Yes. Well, the answer is yes, and I'll share with you an experience that I had. If you want to understand why... If you want to see Congress break out of gridlock and move quickly, go to the Capitol after the last vote of the week, stand in the parking lot,
right,
and watch the entire United States Congress break out of the building like a stampede, plunge down the steps to get in their cars, to get to the airport, to go back home. And one day, I was in a particular rush to get my flight to LaGuardia, and I pushed against the blast-proof doors so hard that I heard somebody scream, ow, and fall next to me. And he looks up at me and he said, you sliced my shoe open. And being a New Yorker, I said, yeah, I got to get my flight. And, and kept going. So 2 weeks later, this is a story that answers the question. 2 weeks later, I happened to be in one of the other truly bipartisan places on Capitol Hill. It's the members' gym.
Yeah.
And, which, by the way, don't believe the internet hoaxes. You have to pay for it the same way you would pay for any fitness club. Right. Members of Congress pay for the gym. And I'm on the bicycle, and there's a guy on the elliptical next to me, and he says, you don't remember me, do you? And I said, no. He said, well, I'm the guy whose shoe you destroyed. And I said, I'm going to send you some money because you should buy better shoes. And we got to talking. His name was Congressman Tim Johnson, Republican from Illinois. He represented the district that Abe Lincoln used to have.
Wow.
And we noticed something, that in the members' gym, Republicans and Democrats played basketball together, handball, paddleball, beautifully. Right. But for some reason, as soon as they went in the elevator and went four flights up to the floor of the house, it became toxic. So Tim and I decided to create something called the House Center Aisle Caucus. Mm-hmm. And I chose 25 Democrats, and Tim chose 25 Republicans. And we met on Monday nights at the Hunan Dynasty Chinese restaurant.
Oh, boy.
Remember that?
Talk about food tester.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is our rule. 5 minutes, state your disagreements. Pick an issue. Say, Obamacare. 5 minutes, state your disagreements. 55 minutes, what can you agree on? Here's what we learned. Democrats and Republicans are going to disagree 75% of the time. There's a reason Ellen and I are Democrats. There was a reason that Tim Johnson was a Republican. It's okay that we disagree 75% of the time. What's not okay is this. We agree 25% of the time. And if we would just focus on that 25% instead of taking 2x4s to one another on the 75%, America would be 100% better off.
Well, we'd get 25% more done. We get zero done now.
Yeah, which is 100%. So that was the most liberating experience. And it proved to me that, yes, you can hold to your principles, your core values, but find areas of agreement. The Center Aisle Caucus went out of business. It was defunct. It was the first casualty of the Tea Party tide in 2010 when Republican moderates came to me and said, I can't come to your dinner. And I'd say, why? And the answer was, because my primary opponent is using it against me in literature.
Right.
They're saying, I joined the Center Aisle Caucus and I'm compromising.
Right. Because that's a dirty four-letter word.
Yeah. So after a while, we had 25 Democrats and Tim Johnson. Tim Johnson, not only did he not, well,
did you ever buy him a shirt?
Retired. Did I ever buy him a shoe? It was the first step in a beautiful relationship. The shoe is now in the Smithsonian Museum as an exhibit of the casualties of bipartisanship. He came up to me once on the floor and he said, I'm leaving. And I said, you mean you're not running in the next election? He said, no, I'm leaving Congress. I can't stand the partisanship anymore.
Right. Yeah.
They left.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a very good question. Do you think there should be a liberal answer to Fox News, or is media liberal enough?
Oh, boy. You know, yes, there were. Well, look, MSNBC is a counter. I'm worried about the tribalization of the media.
Right.
I'm worried about gerrymandering and the tribalization of the media. And I do a lot of work now. I hope to have a podcast called Red Brain, Blue Brain that explains how our brains are literally being rewired and gerrymandered. So if you live in a typical congressional district, chances are you spend all day with people who think as you do. You work all day with people who think as you do. You come home, you turn on either Hannity or Maddow, right? And so our views are being, one view is being reinforced in different areas of our brain. And that is very dangerous for society. When I grew up, you know, and when I was in fourth grade and I decided to run for Congress, I'd go home and I'd listen to Walter Cronkite.
Right, or Dan Rather.
Or Dan Rather, right? And you'd get information. It was news. Now you don't get it. You don't get it. Now here's what's so dangerous about that. Fox News reaches more Democrats on any given night than MSNBC and CNN combined.
Right.
It's the volume. And they are just spewing propaganda, and people are buying it. What we also need in our society, I think we need more not-for-profit news services. Our newspapers are consolidating. Mm-hmm. State and local governments don't get coverage anymore. That's where corruption flourishes, when you don't have a local newspaper reporter filing a Freedom of Information Act request. And so I think we're going to have a new model of not-for-profit journalism that holds government folks accountable.
Yeah. You know, in the end, when you go to Congress, you have to understand that this is public service. It's not really a job. I mean, you get paid for it, but it is not a job. It is public service, and there are lots of sacrifices. You know, Steve went to New York on Friday. He got there a couple of hours later. I was probably just getting to Dulles Airport, getting on a plane, 5-hour flight, 3-hour time change. I only had an hour drive, but a lot of colleagues in California get off a five-hour flight, and then they are driving 2 or 3 hours mm-hmm. or taking another flight to get to other parts of the state. And so it's a big, sacrifice. You're never at the birthday party, the soccer game, the anniversary dinner, or any of the things that you're supposed to be at, because you really are meant to be listening to your constituents so you can go back and serve. But it's the most joyous thing you can do if you get to do it. But at the same time, you know, if you can kind of keep the Constitution, your conscience, and your constituents in your head, and if that's who you believe you're serving. I can remember my mother once telling me, the most important things in life are who and what you're meant to be doing. Who mm-hmm. do you work for, and what are you meant to be doing? And so if you can kind of keep the Congress, you know, if you can go there to do public service, if you understand, if you have to do things because your constituents require it, your conscience requires it, or the Constitution requires it, and you're not going to get reelected, then that's okay.
Yeah.
Go back to your real life.
Mm-hmm.
But for too many people, this becomes a lot of ego and a lot of other things.
They get caught in a bubble.
Yeah.
You did not.
Well, you did not
either.
You're
always authentic.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So the Second Amendment, is it outdated? And if so, how would you consider modifying it?
Yeah. Well, does anybody believe that the writers of the Second Amendment could have possibly imagined 3D printed guns?
Right.
No. So, and if you read the Second Amendment, it's pretty clear.
Right.
It's pretty clear. I'm not sure that the Second Amendment ever will be updated. I think for the time being, we're going to have to rely on state and local governments to make the progress that needs to be made. If there's a Democratic majority in the House, I think you're going to see fundamental reform. I think you'll see no fly, no buy. I think you'll see strengthened background checks. You may see other things. The problem is it's going to die in the Senate.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have to wait until 2020 to get Washington to act on this. And that's going to require a different majority in the House, a different majority in the Senate, and a different president. Between now and then, 30,000 Americans are going to be killed. 60,000 Americans will be killed between now and the 2020 presidential election to guns. We're going to have to rely on state and local governments to try and bring those numbers down until we get to 2020.
Right. So we're getting to the point where we have just a couple minutes for a couple last questions. And I just wanted to ask this one because I think that this is really the crux of what we have to mm-hmm. face in 2020. Does the Democratic Party have to swing to the middle, or can it win by relying on its progressive, excited wing?
Yes. So the answer is we're going through this huge debate now. Is the Democratic Party the party of Alexandria or Tavia Cortez, who just beat Joe Crowley, or is it the party of the Blue Dogs and the New Dems? Here's my answer. Just win.
Yes.
Just win. You can, and here's the thing. I know our time is wrapping up. You're not going to win with one national boilerplate message.
Right.
Not in this midterm environment.
You have to win locally.
You have to do it locally. A message that's going to work in Brooklyn, New York, is not going to land on the same ears in Brooklyn, Iowa, which happens to be a competitive congressional district this midterm. And so you got to think of it, folks, as if you're driving cross country, right? And in some markets, you're going to hear that beautiful country music coming in loud and clear. And in other markets, you're going to hear NPR. Just win in the market that you're running in. Then come to Washington, and then we can talk. Just win.
So isn't the dysfunction in Congress almost entirely due to the influence of money is a question we've already asked. But the second part of it is, what do you believe are the legitimate reasons for an untrained civilian to own a rifle?
So here the Second Amendment does give people the right to bear arms. It doesn't say that you have to be trained or untrained, but it also never contemplated AR-15s, military-style assault weapons. So I don't believe that first of all, I don't believe that there should be assault weapons on the streets. We ought to just end that. There shouldn't be 3D printed guns. I do not understand why the NRA hasn't figured out that they could actually provide a very constructive and lucrative service by providing training to gun owners. You know, they can make a ton of money doing that. God bless them. They should do that. But they have gone, you know, into this tangent. By the way, the reason that they are so extreme is not that they believe this stuff. It's that they're having their own primary. They're being challenged by the right. They're being challenged by another organization called Gun Owners of America that's taking market share away from them. Every time they show signs of moderation, they lose market share. So they're just plunging to the right. And so they've lost their bearings. I believe that there should be some kind of mandatory training. And I don't understand why the NRA hasn't agreed to do that. As a former member of Congress, I would have voted to give them the exclusive franchise on training their members to carry the right and responsible kind of firearms.
Well, I hope you'll all stick around and have a chance to talk to Steve. He's such a great guy and such a great friend.
Thank you.
So glad that he accepted my invitation to come tonight. And I want to thank him, former Congressman Steve Israel, MSNBC commentator and author of the new novel, Big Guns. We also thank everyone here as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We want to remind everyone that there are copies of Steve's book for sale back in the corner, and he will be pleased to sign books in the room immediately following it. I'm Ellen Tauscher, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, San Francisco.
That was great.